we welcome to the program our friend Colin Fleming. His new book, Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, is available everywhere. You can read his work in all kinds of publications on his website at colinflemminglit.com, the Many Moments More blog, and of course, when he's not doing all of that creating, he also, I'm told, serves as the private and batting instructor for Kike Hernandez. Colin Fleming, welcome in.
Help turn it around for the Sox, Kimball.
Indeed, appreciate your work. Nice job there.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't see a single pitch last night, but I woke up in a fog at one point and glanced at the TV, and it looked like it was 11, and I thought, oh, that's good. And that I woke up and hoped it was true. It wasn't a dream. And there it was.
Yeah, it's crazy what they've been able to do. And I don't want to jinx it because, you know, I've been doing this Red Sox thing for more than five decades now. So I know what happens if you get a bit overconfident, but I'm feeling pretty good about this series.
I think that's still going to be pretty tough. I'd be surprised if it doesn't go back to Houston, and your man Chris Sale is going to rear his head again at some point, and that's never good, at least as far as I'm concerned. And but I wrote on the blog today that it's starting to get to that point where this is becoming feasible. You're two wins away, and I think the Dodgers are the best team. I think they're like the Tampa Bay Lightning of MLB. They're just like that kind of far and away, quasi-dynastic type of team. And the Braves are pulling the Red Sox over there, because I don't think the Braves are any better than the Red Sox. And if they end up matching up, although it's a lot of baseball to be played, and I expect the Dodgers to come back. But isn't this hard to believe, though, considering what this team has been for so much of the year, the way they play, the errors and the base running, and then they just melted and had this historic collapse, and here we are. It's pretty cool. It's not a lot better in sports than October baseball when your team's in it.
No, and I think it was Bob Ryan who yesterday when he was on with us said, hey, if it's Red Sox Braves for old guys, even older than me, it's the World Series we should have had back in 1948.
Do you know how few people in the world, Mr. Kimball, know that the Braves were a Boston franchise? I mean, you know, and out of all the people that I know, I think you're probably the only person who would know. So, and I don't, I'm not exactly hanging out with, you know, the characters of Romper Room here. So, yeah, that's a throwback. That's like a post-war, like a Ted Williams was in his prime kind of reference, indeed.
Well, that's me. It's what I like to do. Well, we've got lots on the agenda this week. Where to begin? Let's start with a terrific live set recorded in Germany with The Dead doing what to me was an unexpected cover of The Rascals' Good Lovin'. And man, it was great.
This one, Kimball, I mean, you're a hard guy to sort of figure out. You know, they call you the Enigma from Bangor. So maybe you haven't heard that. But you're so enigmatic that you haven't heard it when one would suspect you had. This I was listening to this the other day, and I thought, right, Hard Rock and Rich Kimball is going to love this because he probably likes the original version. He's going to enjoy the beginning of this song. And then it just becomes so much better when they're not even doing the great sort of cover of the song. They're going off in this other direction. And it's sung by Pigpen. So this is in Europe. It's 1972, spring of 72. And The Dead had this idea that they would record all of these shows, and that would justify the cost of the tour, because then they would, like, have a live album. It would make lots of money. So you get the complete run of, I think it's 22 shows from these spring tours. I've never heard, I mean, to me, they're easily the best American band. They might be the best band ever in terms of just playing. I don't know anyone who can, I don't just mean rock and roll, I mean jazz too. It blows my mind how good these guys are. And this is sort of like the 10-minute touchstone. If you are new to The Dead, or you've heard Bad Things, or you think it's just like old hippie music and boring and all that stuff, this just cooks. And it's sung by Pigpen, who wasn't long for the world. He was sort of like their earthy blues shouter, and he's going to die shortly thereafter, after they get back from this tour. And they're playing so incredibly tight, and there's this moment where he's vocalizing, he's almost rapping, and it's like fitting in with the guitars and everything, and he just yells out, "Tighten up." I'm thinking, like, what? And they get even tighter. It's just, it's sublime. I mean, have you ever heard a band play any tighter than that?
No, and that's what was impressive about it, is it all feels simultaneously very improvisational and freestyle and yet incredibly tight. And it just shows how much they had worked with each other and knew each other and understood how to make it all work. But no, it was phenomenal.
I've never heard anything like this band when they were doing their thing in their prime. Never anything. And it sounded like a strange comparison that I made on Twitter, but I think they're the band that has the most in common with the modern day NHL. And it's another like, oh, making me scratch my head, Fleming. It's like, I would say that 80% of the goals in the current version of the NHL are scored off of transition. They're not scored like, oh, here comes a guy, he's rushing into the zone, and the team had possession, kept possession, there's the goal. It's when there's a turnover, and immediately the other team that was on defense is now attacking, going the other way. And it happens so quickly that after that turnover, after that transition, the puck is in the net. And the NHL didn't used to be like that. I've never heard a band transition like the Grateful Dead transition. There's not like some sort of like ramping up to we're going into this next thing. Sometimes I don't even know how they do it. It's like this magic button they push instantaneously. And all these different guys who are in this dialogue with each other. And you hear like the bass like roaring up in the mix, and it's like leading the charge. But no, it's been the guitar, the lead guitar, Jerry Garcia helping it out. And then they're just in this other key. They're in this other song. They're in this other improvisation. I mean, it's like a magic act for your ears. Blows my mind every single time I hear it. In this particular concert, just like spread across like what, like four discs. They do it, I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of times. It's just, it's some of the most transcendent, inspirational, beautiful music. It's like Bach. I mean, it's that good. They really were that good.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. From there, we go to a wonderful short story by H.H. Munro Saki called Shrendi Vashtar. I had no idea where this story was going. It started with me reading about this little boy who was likely not long for this world. And then, well, the next thing I know, there's a magical ferret.
Yeah, godlike ferret. And it's funny. Sometimes, like, when I think I'm just throwing random things out there, like, we should talk about these things, and then you sort of, like, take us into the next section, I can pick up on what my mind might have been thinking, because talk about the dead and that idea of surprises, and this is the prose version of surprises, because people have said a version of what you just said about my own work. I thought it was going to be this, and I didn't know where it was going to go, and then it went here. And I think that's the best kind of writing, where you don't know what's coming. You don't read the first two lines and think, ah, it's one of those, and then you just kind of see it through. So this is about a kid who has to go live with his cousin, his older cousin, this woman, and he doesn't like her. And so to cope with his situation, he really retreats into the world of his imagination, and there's a shed out behind the house, and he keeps like a chicken in there, like his pet chicken, and a ferret. And a ferret's not like really the most charming kind of animal, right? Like when I see people on dating sites and they have a ferret, they don't get a Fleming, Kimball.
They get a well, good luck.
Yeah, they get a great good luck when I said, because you don't want to be over like somebody's place, because I imagine it's like late at night and you hear like the low growl of the ferret. Like a ferret would be pretty territorial.
Right. Why are you snuggling with her? That's my job.
Yeah, maybe this is like because I have the story on the brain. So the kid turns his ferret in his imagination into this god, and he worships the ferret. That's where the sort of like Indian sounding name Shrendi Vashtar comes from. It's like you wouldn't have to worry about someone else having that title. And so the woman becomes suspicious of like what's going on with the shed, and she goes out there, and first she gets rid of his chicken. Like sells that, so he hates her even more. So she goes out there, why is he still going out to the shed? And she thinks like within this hut she's going to find like guinea pigs, and it turns out that the ferret comes out of the shed alone, and it has, and Saki doesn't even tell you what it is. It's like this wetness all around the fur and its mouth, and the woman doesn't come out, and the kid hears something like a scream, and then something heavy carried into the house. And the creepiest detail, I think, the crowning touch, is that he's like eating buttered toast. This is going on.
Yes.
And you can piece it together. It's not spelled out. Like, the ferret is like bitten through this woman's throat. And so then he has another piece of toast. The end.
It's wonderful. And much like in your work, in very limited words, I think this whole story is less than 2,000 words. And yet,
way less.
Incredibly deep, multi-dimensional characters that you learn a lot about. Not to break it down too much, but what is the secret to doing that? How are you able to, how is he able to create these characters that we seem to know so much about in such limited time and limited words?
Right away, you have to go in possessing like the tonal voice. You have to, it's as if you've lived this. And you can feel it like in every last pore you have. So you're speaking from every last pore. You're like that person. You've come back from like this event, and now you're reporting on it. So you know things like, in conversations, for instance, it's just not what people say to each other. It's like the way their head is cocked and the tone of their voice and like what they are doing with their hand and their hair. All of these kind of details convey information. So you have to be on this scene that didn't really exist. And then you have to have every single word count for more than one word. But you can't, like, overwhelm a reader where they think it's like, oh, it's this thing I'm not supposed to get. But each word really has to have, like, all of these different pockets of meaning to it. So the words are, like, sixfold, really. So it's actually, like, longer in that sense. So then you're also using words to paint. And so you have to move quickly where sometimes I'll see a painting and I'll see something like that Van Gogh accomplished with just a quick turn of his wrist. And it accomplishes a lot pictorially. Well, you have to accomplish a lot at the level of the prose with just a quick turn of your wrist. But a lot of it seriously is an attitude of going in where you know these people. And when you're talking about people you know, you're not trying to discover them in your own writing, which is what a lot of people do. They write and they hope to sort of have a character come clear because they don't already know that character. So I think you have to have the characters already out there in the world. They have to come to you, share their experience, and then you have that total confidence because you were on their particular scene. But you're right. This is a story with an idea to die for, and that's key too, because it's just like, even when I sum up the plot, that's a great idea for a story. And no one either also would have the balls to do something like that because, yeah, technically a ferret could do this. Is it like that likely? Like, no. But still, it's also about these other things too, like the power of imagination and what's real, and this kid finding coping exercises for himself. And you end up with a whole lot of like things. It's almost like a latchkey child sort of story, an only child type of thing too. So definitely a unique story, but there are ways to do something like that.
I also enjoyed the heck out of this production by the Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater of the Buoy. It was so well done. I loved them. The sound effects were terrific, and I love the narrator.
It was, it's from 1987. This is a rarity. So we've talked about radio episodes many, 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 many times. This is one of a more recent vintage, but it's actually harder to find. Well, it's not that hard to find now. It's on YouTube, but there was a time. It's not like this was on the collector's market being so relatively recent. And I think the only sort of weakness in this, the only kind of amateur element is the current day person who's like saved in the end. But we start out with this guy in a boat. He's just like this kind of like pretend scene setter, and he's out in the fog. And I just found this like incredibly evocative that he's so specific as he goes out in the night off of Cape Cod. Obviously, like, I'm into this because of Buried on the Beaches and everything, my book about the Cape. And he's very specific in how he's describing like the local geography, the points you're going past and all that. And it just really puts you in that picture. And he witnesses something that we're going to find out about. And the story then goes to this guy who's missed the last ferry from this spot in the Cape. So he's marooned and he has to stay over at this in, which is the type of thing that happened then. It's the type of thing that, happens now when you miss the last boat. And he meets with this visitor as he's warming himself by the fire. The visitor tells him this story that's going to have, like, a lot of science in it, too, right? The whole, like, yeah. the alignment of planets and the moon and the tides and what's that doing. And he had this experience, the guy's telling him about, where he was kidnapped from his room. And he was chained to a buoy. He's taken out in a boat and chained to a buoy to drown with the tide. And it's like this pit in the pendulum type story. And this guy, though, is not who he seems to be. We find him yet.
And I found some great information that they put in a lot of time recording most of those sound effects out in the field. And boy, it pays off because they're great.
This is one of the better, more suspenseful. I mean, this was really well done. I would have just liked it because, again, my partiality for Cape Cod, not just because of the book, but I love the Cape. I want to have a house there. I was born there and all that stuff. But if this was the Gulf Coast of Florida, I would still really be into this because, like you said, it's well done. And the guy who ends up telling most of the story, so it's not like the kind of the person who, as it were, is going to be saved, who is stranded that night. The person telling most of the story, he's excellent. And the details reminds me a little bit of something like, again, Quiet Place, where the thing on the Forbel board, there's so much information about drilling into the earth. There's so much information here about tides and syzygy. Like, right? Like, they really went to town on this with the research. And it's convincing. And I think it's also especially well done when it seems like the guy is going to be rescued because it's going to be close with the tide. And really, it's just, I don't know. I knew you'd like that one because it does have the elements of Poe and it has the elements of that Orson Welles, remember him starring in The Hitchhiker? There's right. an element of that. But this really stands apart. And it's much better than the rest of the Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater productions, too. Not that they're bad, but this is definitely kind of like their MVP.
We've talked about M.R. James quite a bit, and I love hearing, and I wish I need to listen to and watch more of them. BBC, was it 1971, decided to do Christmas ghost stories?
Yes, they had. So it's an entire series of made-for-TV films. It's called A Ghost Story for Christmas. And sort of like the first one, the unofficial first one, was Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, with my guy, Michael Horton, who's Marley, 1951 Scrooge. Another book coming up soon for everybody to buy, December 1st. Thanks. And they kept on throughout the 70s. So the 70s were a great decade for the BBC with horror productions. Now, not all of the Ghost Stories for Christmas were M.R. James stories, but, for instance, there's one, The Signal Man, the Charles Dickens story, but most of them were M.R. James, and this is so from 50 years ago. And it's one of the better ones. It's about an archdeacon who wants a job of, like, to be the main guy of his church, like competitive church people. But his predecessor won't die. He's really healthy. Gets into his 90s. And there's like something really shady with how this dude does eventually succumb by falling down his stairs. And the person who takes his position, like the protagonist of the film, he has some problems going forward with carvings in his stall at the church. And there is a black cat. You know how I feel about those. But hearing these voices and as all of this is going on, it's sort of like being pieced together by these more or less current, well, for like M.R. James, like librarians, like these historians that are going through all these old papers, and they're trying to understand what happened. And so you're like reading some of the guy's writings where he's like, I must be strong, where he thinks that everything is coming from some fault within himself, like he's not accepting that this could be some bad supernatural juju, which is, of course, what it is, and he's going to meet his end in a very congruous way with his predecessor.
And maybe because of where they filmed it, it feels very much of its time, set in the 1930s. It's a really good atmospheric piece.
even when they're walking, the various characters are walking on the flagstones, producing that echo, it puts you there. Like, it really does. And the colors, it's not a very bright film. Mm. It's a kind of washed out. And I feel like that palette is like, it matches your mood. It like sort of just creeps into you as you're watching. And it's very gray and England and rainy. And even when it's not raining, it feels like it's raining. It's like, that's how gray and overclouded it is. And it's a great mood. It takes some liberties with the stories, but I feel like you have to when you film M.R. James, but it's definitely one of the best of that series. I mean, that series too. I mean, I love it. You can watch them all. I think they're all available on YouTube, or you just want to hunt around out there, because they're the ones from the 70s are all worth it. Some of my favorite viewing, like when I look to my future, I sort of envision myself, like when I daydream now, I tell myself to stay focused. I want to be having like tea late at night in like Rockport by the sea, like watching like these particular productions. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of them.
And I don't know how I managed to make it this far without knowing about this Christopher Lee audiobook of Dracula, which is just, it's fantastic.
It's actually pretty hard to find. Somebody put it up on YouTube not that long ago. So like Christopher Lee, you can listen to him. I put up a bunch of them on the blog pretty recently, like last week, I think. You can listen to him reading like Edgar Allan Poe, and there's some other like sort of Dracula stuff. But this is, I feel like it's the best reading I've ever heard anyone do of a text, of a well-known text. Like, he doesn't just read it, and I don't want to say that he does voices, but he does something kind of in between where he has these inflections that he doesn't have in any of his other readings. I mean, if it doesn't give you nightmares, you could put it next to your ear when you go to sleep and fall asleep to the cadences at night. It's a work of reading art, wouldn't you say? Like, I'm just floored by how well he does this. I really like Christopher Lee. I like him in so many things. And just the elocution and the erudition in this voice, I mean, it really takes you away from our world now, doesn't it, Lal Ratafel, all this?
Well, he starts it out so low-key, which is great, because, you know, you could start a bit over-dramatic at the beginning there, and then you have nowhere to go. But there's a constant buildup, a crescendo, getting to where he eventually goes in this. And, yeah, he's brilliant. And I like the way you described it. He plays those characters. He brings them to life, but with very little change in his voice.
He does. And like I said, it really stands apart from, I don't know why he did it this way, because he doesn't do any other readings quite this way. And it's not, I mean, it's very abridged. It's like less than 3 hours. It's less than 2 hours. It's just sort of like hitting the high points. But it's thorough, like especially at the beginning when it's like going to Dracula's castle and the journal entries and all that stuff. Because Dracula is a collage novel. It's not just it's not written straight through. It has like all of these bits and pieces to it, and like, here's the journal, here's the letter, here's the news account, here's like the voice recording, like that kind of thing. And I think Christopher Lee, for all of his association with Dracula, people don't know it. I mean, I don't know what people know. I always struggle with that. But he was Dracula for a long time in the Hammer horror film, starting like in 1958 with, well, it was just Dracula in England. It was Horror of Dracula here in the States. So like in the 50s, late 50s and 60s and on into the early 70s even, like he was the first sort of in color Dracula. Mm. Bela Lugosi, of course, black and white, that antique from 1931. So Christopher Lee was a lot of people's idea of the modern Dracula. And so I think he's even better reading this novel by Stoker, though, than he is in his Dracula role, because accepting like that first film, Horror of Dracula, he doesn't get to speak a lot. He wears red contact lenses, and he looks a great Dracula. But this is just, it's a prose symphony. And I think the Stoker novel is incredibly underrated. People trash it as trash, which bothers me. It's just like pulp and all this stuff. But I feel like it was a form of proto-modernism, because who was building a collage novel like that? It came out in 1897. So you don't get to things like Ulysses until 1922, and I think sort of like Stoker was a forerunner of the modernist period that was to follow.
Yeah, and I put this version right up there on my pedestal with the Orson Welles Mercury Theater version of Dracula.
Yeah, the Orson Welles one is like, it has like that scratchy sound, but I think that was one of the best, that's a good point, that was one of the best ones that the Mercury did, and it was really early, it was 1938, so it's like 3 years before Citizen Kane, and Welles is just, he's really going for it in that, he plays Dracula in that adaptation, it's very sexual and very sort of like groany and grunty and all of that stuff, and he doesn't stint on that. Whereas Lee is somewhat more urbane. When Welles would do horror on his own, he did have a tendency to that, like, earthiness. I mean, like, quite literal earthiness. If you think of something like Macbeth, his film production of that, where, like, they live in this kind of, like, primordial ooze, these thanes and, like, this, like, melted vegetation and everything. But it's funny you mention Welles, because there's a reading he did of John Donne that maybe we can talk about sometime, where that's the only other thing I've heard in terms of a reading of someone else's text that I would put at the level of this Christopher Lee. I mean, it's shocking to me how outstanding it truly is. It's his own work of art.
You mentioned the Scrooge book. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so the Scrooge book is sort of like the film version of the Sam Cooke book. So it's an entire book about the film, and this would be the 1951 version that was released on Halloween as Alistair Sim. Mm. I think it's everyone's kind of now. It wasn't well-regarded for a long time because it's so dark, but I think it's everybody's definitive version of A Christmas Carol now. That's what it was retitled as in the States. So what I'm actually doing is, with this book that comes out on December 1st, is going to Amazon. It's looking at it as the ultimate horror film for any time of the year, and especially the ultimate horror film for right now, because you have a guy who's broken, who is depressed, who takes to his bed. And like when the spirits come and he has to deal with reality, Scrooge's solution in this film is to hide in bed. And I think that's a lot of people now. So it's like weirdly this horror film of the social media age, and it's not a version of A Christmas Carol that has a lot of Christmas trappings. Like, it's very non-Christmassy, but you get German expressionism, like, out of Nosferatu and film noir and the way it's lit and everything. And it was written by the same guy who did The Wizard of Oz, which in many ways is quite a scary movie in parts, the witch and the flying monkeys and all of that. So it's the one masterpiece that this director, Brian Desmond Hurst, made. It was fine, but this is his masterpiece, and so it's my all-time favorite film, and I do my thing where it's like, okay, this is about this film, and let's talk about why it's so amazing and so relevant and why it's maybe the best horror film ever made, but I also write it so it's not just for people who like the film or even for people who have no idea what the film is. So it's always like that idea of, okay, you get this, and you get this, because you never want to just sort of like stop at the level of your subject. You want to produce something that's beyond that, really. Or at least that's my goal always. And it's my first film book. And like I said, it's for all my film stuff and all my love of film, this is my all-time favorite. And it also ties into my life, because I was adopted, and I had two sisters, and they were also adopted, and they were recalled by their biological parents, and they were taken from our family. And for a while as a kid, I was deeply scarred. I had to go to therapy and all that because I thought I was going to be returned. And in the middle of the night one time, I went wandering, and I went downstairs, and like magically this film was playing on the TV like at 2 a.m. And there was young little me, and I sat and I was enchanted, and it really helped me. And so that portion of the story is in there too.
Well, I can't wait to read the book and then rewatch it as I do every year, because I love the film as well. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Thank you as always, Colin. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
All right. Sounds good, sir.